This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 204. Today we speak with Carl Truman about the King James Bible. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 204. My name is Camden Busey. I'm here at Westminster Theological Seminary with Dr. Carl Truman, who is professor of historical theology. Is it and church history? You're the man who is both, as well as being the academic dean. So I'm very pleased to have you here, Dr. Truman. It's great to have you back.
It's great to be here, Camden.
Today we're going to be speaking about a special occasion we have coming up here that will... just about this time, the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible. And in conjunction with that, Dr. Truman has spoken on a video. He appears on the film KJB, The Book That Changed the World, which is available all over the place. You can get it on Amazon. I'll put a link in the show notes. But today we want to speak about the historical context surrounding the King James Bible, all the different figures, including King James, and all the other people that were involved in its production, and talk about its influence and its place in the world today. Now, Dr. Truman, just to let people know, this video, if they're hoping to get it and to see a lot of you in it, as you mentioned in your previous lecture, you appear for about 45 seconds.
Yeah, I think so. That may be a generous estimate, actually. Two brief shots right at the beginning and one at the end.
Do you recall what your two lines were?
I think my first line is, James was a political genius, and I think my closing line was, it's exalted prose expressing exalted content.
Yeah, very apropos statements, I might add.
Absolutely, and you need a PhD to say them with authority.
Authority, right. Otherwise, they just don't land with that same punch. Of course, many people are familiar with the King James Bible. I mean, I can't imagine many Christians who speak and read English haven't at least encountered it in some way, shape, or form. But yet, there's a general ignorance of people not understanding exactly where it came from, what were its the principal reasons from which it arose. So in order to understand the creation of this great Bible, we need to understand a bit about the historical context. Can you provide for us some information about some of the salient features leading up to and during the creation of the King James Bible?
Sure. There's a large amount of context, of course, in the production of the King James Version of the Bible. First, there's the general Reformation context, with the shift towards the importance of preaching, the importance of vernacular liturgy, the importance of communicating the gospel in the vernacular. It was inevitable that vernacular Bible translation would be an important part of all of the continental reformations, Lutheran, Reformed, and Anglican. Secondly, there is a history of Bible translation in England that goes back to the 14th century, when John Wycliffe commissioned and inspired his followers, the lay preachers called the Lollards, to translate the Bible from the Latin, the Vulgate, into the vernacular. And that became the basis for Lollard preaching. It's often thought of as a proto-Protestantism. It's more a movement of kind of lay reform with an emphasis upon the need for preaching, the centrality of preaching, and a general dislike of a high sacramentalism and the Roman hierarchy. Then within the context of English Bible translation in the 16th century, the big precursor to the King James Version of the Bible is the Geneva Bible. The Geneva has its roots in the translation work of William Tyndale in the 1520s and early 1530s. And the Geneva put together in 1560 in Geneva by a group of English exiles became the Bible of choice of what we might call the Puritan party within the Church of England. The Puritan party were those churchmen who were pushing for a more thorough reformation of the Church of England. They disliked the idea, for example, of kneeling at communion. They disliked the fact that they were required to wear clerical vestments, clerical dress. And most controversially, many of them wanted to separate the power of the church and the power of the state. not in some Jeffersonian sense that you would have a kind of First Amendment situation with a clear separation of church and state as you do in the United States today. But they wanted a church that could organize its own discipline and appoint its own pastors. That created all kinds of tensions in the 16th century, where the model was very much to see church and state as very, very closely linked. The Geneva Bible was produced by these Puritan-inclined individuals in Geneva. And one of the controversial things about the Bible was that it had marginal notes.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little bit like an early study Bible, if you like. Many of us will own study Bibles, which have very helpful brief commentaries in the margins, helping us get some sort of handle on more difficult texts. The Geneva Bible had explanatory notes, many of which, if you looked at today, would not strike you as at all exceptional or offensive, and they weren't offensive in the 16th century. But there were one or two that were really quite provocative and controversial. Most famous was the comment on Exodus 1. If you remember the story in Exodus 1, the Hebrew midwives are hiding the male children born in Israel and then lying to cover up their actions. And the marginal note in the Geneva Bible says something to the effect of the Hebrew midwives were right to disobey Pharaoh, even though they shouldn't have lied.
Mm-hmm.
That effectively sanctions rebellion against a monarch. And that was one of the controversial notes in the Geneva Bible. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions that we face looking at English Bible translation in particular is, why was it so controversial in the 16th century? Other European nations, or nations slightly anachronistic, but other European countries had had vernacular Bible translations before the Reformation and had not been controversial. For example, in Germany, there was the so-called Mentell Bible of 1466. Translation of the Bible into the German language was not controversial at all. But when William Tyndale in the 1520s is looking for a sponsor for his English translation, he can't get anyone to sponsor it. He goes to Cuthbert Tunstall, the Bishop of London, and asks Tunstall if he will sponsor an English translation of the Bible. Tunstall refuses. The question is, why? Why is it so controversial in England? Well, you have to go back to the end of the 14th, the beginning of the 15th century, with these figures, the Lollards, these lay-preaching followers of John Wycliffe, who were both anti-papal, anti-sacramental, and also intimately and inextricably connected with the idea of vernacular scriptures. Not only that, but in the 14th century, there's a major rebellion against the crown led by a man called Sir John Oldcastle that is seen as a Lollard-inspired rebellion. So Lollardy is seen as seditious. And I think in the English mind, certainly in the English Catholic stroke, noble stroke, monarchical mind, there is a connection between vernacular scriptures and political insurrection. It's not an entirely arbitrary connection. We do know from studies that were done in South America in, I think, the 1950s and 60s about the impact of literacy on people, that as cultures become more literate and become more word-centered, people become more politically radical. So when you look at the Lollard movement and see it as a literary movement and a movement that's emphasizing words, it's not unusual to see a rising political consciousness. And when you have a rising political consciousness, you tend to have more challenges to the status quo. So by the beginning of the 16th century, English Bible translation in many minds, I think, equals political insurrection. So when Tyndale goes to Tunstall and says, you know, Lord Bishop, will you sponsor my translation of the Bible? And Tyndale's not a Protestant at this point. He's really an Erasmian. Tunstall's going to be thinking, Bible translation, isn't that what politically subversive people do? And not be so keen on it. So Lollardy is very important for creating suspicion about Bible translation in England. The Geneva Bible, of course, before the Geneva Bible, there is the Great Bible in churches in England from 1537 onwards. England does have an English translation of the Bible, not a particularly good one. The Geneva Bible is a much better translation. But the Geneva Bible, as I've said, does nothing to soothe the nerves about political insurrection because of that brief little comment on the Hebrew midwives, which was seen as opening up a whole can of worms. And you know, when you've got things coming out of Geneva in the late 1550s, like John Knox advocating rebellion against idolatrous monarchs, writing works that say that, you know, women holding power should be overthrown, the whole context of Geneva is very seditious. I must just say a word not in favor of John Knox, but to sort of mitigate John Knox on the overthrow women in power side of things. Every woman in power that he ever came across wanted to have him burned at the stake. And as I say to students here, while we don't agree with Knox, we can at least understand why he would not have been well disposed towards women monarchs when he associated them with trying to have him killed in rather unpleasant ways. Cut forward to the start of the 17th century. King of England, James VI becomes King of Scotland, James VI becomes King of England. James I of England, when Elizabeth I dies without issue. James is a big believer in what we would call the absolute power of the monarchy, or the divine right of kings, as he would have referred to it. This idea that the king has the absolute right to dictate what goes on in the church, and also allows no scope whatsoever for rebellion. To a man like James, the King James Version, the Geneva Bible is seditious, and potentially something that could provoke rebellion.
Now, for some people who might not know much about James or his family, yeah, where he came from, and you mentioned, yeah, the fact that he was king of two nations, yeah, what is James' lineage for us Americans who aren't steeped in this the British crown history, sure, and why was it significant, his particular history and who he was?
James is the son of the lady who's come down in history known as Mary, Queen of Scots. She was actually the daughter of the French Princess Mary of Guise, who ruled Scotland as a regent in the middle of the 16th century. When Mary of Guise died, rather suddenly of a heart attack, I think, Mary, Queen of Scots, became queen. And this created problems in Scotland. The Reformation in Scotland is different to that in England. England, the Reformation, is driven by the monarchy, often in the face of opposition from the nobility. In Scotland, the position's reversed. The Reformation is driven by the nobility in face of the opposition of a Catholic monarchy. Mary, Queen of Scots, is a Catholic monarch. She does all kinds of provocative things. She wants to celebrate Mass at Holyrood Palace in Edinburgh, which, of course, for Protestants like John Knox, that's not just the equivalent of a private citizen celebrating Mass. This is the Queen, the person who embodies the state, celebrating Mass. Mm-hmm. When David commits adultery in ancient Israel, the nation commits adultery. Mm-hmm. When Mary, Queen of Scots, commits spiritual adultery by celebrating Mass, the nation commits spiritual adultery. So ultimately, she's forced to abdicate by the Scottish Protestant nobles and is replaced on the throne by her one-year-old son, James. James's coronation, the fiery John Knox, actually preaches the coronation, mm-hmm, sermon. So James is brought up and educated by the Protestant nobles. His most notable tutor is a man called George Buchanan, who was one of the sharpest scholars of his day, and if this is not to mix metaphors, a thunderous and fiery Calvinist. It sounds kind of Scottish to put it that way. But by all accounts, a rather humorless and fearsome, brilliant scholar, Presbyterian Calvinist.
And did he pass that on to James? Was he equipped and adept in maybe even theological matters?
James is a very sharp intellect. Mm-hmm. He was taught by the best. He was very bright. He was undoubtedly, I think, the cleverest person ever to sit on the throne of England. I always facetiously comment that, you know, the bar set pretty low for cleverness in terms of the throne in England. But James was without doubt a scholar, very clever and astute individual, very well trained, knew his Reformed theology very thoroughly. He corresponded, for example, with the Synod of Dort on points such as the imputation of the active and passive righteousness of Christ. Those are quite fine, yeah, theological distinctions. Mm-hmm. So he was a thoughtful,
especially at that time,
man. Yeah, knew his Reformed, mm-hmm, theology, but hated Presbyterianism. And he hated Presbyterianism because Well, partly he saw it as that which had undone his mother, the opposition of the Presbyterian nobility, and you know she was ultimately executed. This has to be traumatic. To lose a parent is traumatic. To have a parent executed, one can only imagine how traumatic that must have been. And Presbyterianism also sanctioned what he saw as rebellion. It clipped the power of the monarchy. And that, for James, was seditious and dangerous. So while he grew up under the control of Presbyterian nobles in Scotland, that did nothing but make him deeply resent and hate Presbyterianism.
I'm interested to know how conflicted James would have been himself, knowing that he represents in himself and the entire nation, but yet he has this varied religious history, tutors of one stripe, mother of a different stripe. How did this play out for him, especially since he was so sharp? And how did that maybe come into effect later on?
I'm not aware of any vestiges of sympathy for Catholicism in James. He certainly resented, I can't remember the exact phrase, but it's a very striking phrase that he uses about the execution of his mother. A very troublesome business or something. He was not a fan of the execution of his mother. That almost goes without saying. But there's no evidence, I don't think, that he was particularly Catholic in his sympathies. It's always an interesting question to what extent a public figure has a private faith. It's very difficult to reconstruct the private convictions of a public figure because they're always playing a public role. We find a similar situation with Oliver Cromwell. To what extent was Cromwell a convinced Calvinistic Puritan? It's difficult to know. We do know from James's public actions that he appears to have been intellectually committed to Reformed theology and intellectually committed and practically committed as well to a high Episcopalianism that fitted into an Erastian form of church government where the monarch was ultimately the man who held the keys, if you like, was the supreme governor of the church.
Clearly. Now, we've spoken a little bit and you've let us know how sharp he was intellectually. How do you picture James? How much you describe him in non-intellectual terms? What did he look like? I mean, how did people view him?
I was always traumatized as a child by my father used to read me Dickens. Night, Tale of Two Cities, Barnaby Rudge, all that great stuff. And one of the lesser-known Dickens books is A Child's History of England, which is a super, if somewhat fanciful, history of the nation of England. If you go to the section on James I, and my dad was a big Cavalier guy, always pushing the Civil War at me. I've come to a more Cromwellian roundhead position on that, but my dad was a big royalist Cavalier guy. And I remember him reading the description of James as this man whose tongue was too large for his mouth, and he sort of slobbered over his courtiers, and he was just a sort of physically revolting human being. Does not appear to be the portrait painted of him. Do not present him as physically repulsive.
Well, those painters wouldn't last very long.
Well, one has to remember these things are commissioned. Just remember that Luther's wife was. She hated the portraits that were painted of her because she always thought she was much more beautiful than Lucas Cranach presented her as. So we have accounts of him as being physically not very pleasant. He was almost certainly an active homosexual, had an affair with the Duke of Buckingham by all accounts. He did have one moment of romance in his life where Anne of Denmark, his fiancée, is supposed to be coming from Denmark to Scotland for the marriage, and because the storms are up and the seas are high, word gets to James that they're not going to make the journey. They're going to delay the journey. And James rallies a couple of hundred loyal subjects, jumps onto a boat and sails over to Denmark to bring his bride back to Scotland. And that's his sort of one. If you're going to make a movie about James, you'll have to focus on that incident because that's the one moment of real romance and swashbuckling panache.
The Hollywood instant.
Yeah.
So this is who James kind of grew up to be. That's primed. We've primed the canon really to get into that, but to get into his political prowess and the events surrounding the King James Bible. But I think there's one last thing I'd like to explore. And when James was crowned King of Scotland as an infant, there was a sort of a group regency, correct, until he was old enough to reign. Do you think this experience prepared him for the challenges ahead of him as King of England? Do you think it might have even motivated him more and stoked the fires of his divine right views at all?
Almost certainly. Again, it's difficult to speculate about, what impact does a childhood and growing up have on the psychology of the adult? It's difficult. We all know that it does have huge impact. How you go about exploring that and reconstructing it can end up being highly speculative. But it seems to me that he is left with a lasting suspicion of those lower down the hierarchy lording it over those higher up the hierarchy. So it would seem entirely reasonable to me to say, yes, his experience in Scotland leaves him with a desire to make sure that the monarchy is as strong as possible. And, of course, part of that is establishing an Erastian form of church government, not a Presbyterian form.
Now, inevitably, with a regency like that, where whenever you don't have a strong crown, you're going to end up with more and more power struggles and competing factions. Yeah. And do you think witnessing much of that as he grew up and as he came of age, do you think that in turn also prepared and maybe even gave him some additional political skills and prowess that came into effect later on?
Could well have done. Because one of the things that if you look at the history of strong leadership, you often find that powerful leaders, the danger of being a powerful leader is you're surrounded by powerful and ambitious people.
Mm-hmm.
That's the nature of leadership. And there's always somebody out there who wants your job. So your number one problem as a powerful leader is, how do I stop these ruthless and ambitious people from getting rid of me and taking my place? Well, there are various options. There's the kind of the Stalin option. You just regularly cull people. That has its own advantages and drawbacks from a leadership position. Mm-hmm. Another approach would be what I'd call the kind of the Hitler option. And what Hitler did was really quite clever, in that Hitler made sure that his rivals were always sort of too busy fighting each other to be able to take the Führership, if you like. Mm-hmm. A lot of research has been done on Hitler is quite a lazy, lazy dictator. Well, how does a lazy man stay at the top for so long? He makes sure that all the busy, hardworking people are busy, hardworking people fighting each other, not fighting him. And I think one of the things that James probably picks up is a realization that if you can divide people against themselves, or you can put them in positions where they're having to work together, it's very difficult for them to make life difficult for you. You can have a kind of stability that comes out of containing the struggles within theaters that you yourself establish.
That's quite fascinating. And so to lead things back to the Bible translations, this is James the man, the thinker, the political genius, the one who can navigate through these different power struggles. Why did the issue of a new Bible translation come up in the first place?
Sure.
And why was that significant?
Well, the first thing is, I've already said, James regarded the Geneva Bible not only as inadequate, but as positively seditious. So he doesn't like the Geneva Bible because the notes are essentially consistent with, we would say, Presbyterianism, certainly not consistent with the kind of Erastianism that James wants to establish. Secondly, James inherits, James has a number of problems when he becomes king. One, he's going to have to establish some kind of religious policy for the three kingdoms, Ireland, England, and Scotland. Three kingdoms. Wales is just a principality, so we can kind of set that to one side. But you've got three kingdoms that you've got to govern. You're king of England and Ireland, and you're also king of Scotland. Do you have separate religious policies? Do you have a united religious policy? You've got to make a critical decision at that point. He also inherits in England a divided church. The church in Scotland is divided. The church in Scotland is dominated by Presbyterians, but has a powerful faction that want to see a more Episcopalian sort of setup. Mm. It is a source of shame to myself that my own university, the University of Aberdeen, was on the kind of Episcopalian side of that debate. The other universities were all on the right side. So you have a divided church in Scotland. You have an even more divided church in England, where you have Puritans pushing for a more thorough reformation of the Church of England, and what we might call conformists, who really want the forms, the Book of Common Prayer, the crown. They're all very happy with the Elizabethan settlement, and want the Elizabethan settlement really imposed to sort of squeeze the Puritans, if you like. The Puritans, of course, have every reason to believe that when a Scottish king, brought up in Presbyterian context, trained by none other than the legendary George Buchanan, is coming south from Scotland to take the crown. He's inherited the crown. He's coming south to be crowned. They have every reason to believe that this is their man. This is their moment. They've been struggling under Elizabeth, who, for all of the fact that she allowed what we would say Calvinists to rise to the top of the Church of England, like Archbishop Whitgift, Elizabeth was not at all well disposed towards the Puritan agenda. So the Puritans have every reason to believe that James is going to be more sympathetic. And as he's on his way down from Edinburgh, he's met by a group who present him with a petition that's traditionally called the Millenary Petition, because the legend was, and certainly the propaganda they put out about it was signed by 1,000 clergy of Puritan sympathies. Who knows how many signed it? Certainly not more than 1,000, or they'd have told you it was more than 1,000. It's likely to be some proportion less than that. But it was an indication of the strength of feeling, and it was a call for a more thorough reformation of the Church of England. So James has, even before he's arrived in London, he knows he's coming to a divided church. You have the, what we might call the Erastian Episcopalians, who are wanting to push for the Elizabethan settlement, and you have the Puritans, who really want the clock turned back to a time where they felt they could get a more Puritan settlement. So James is immediately faced by this problem. He's going to have a divided church. How's he going to handle it? Because, of course, this is the 16th century, 17th century. Theology is always political and vice versa. You can't have a stable political situation which isn't also a stable theological situation, or vice versa for that matter.
So he's forced to find some way to get everyone at least to be able to live with each other.
Yeah. He calls the Hampton Court Conference.
And what happened there?
There he meets, he gets the representatives of the Puritan faction and the, as I say, the Conformist, the Establishment faction. The Establishment headed by Archbishop John Whitgift. The Puritans headed up by a man called John Reynolds. And they meet at Hampton Court, which was the, you know, Buckingham Palace is the palace of today. Hampton Court was the palace built by Henry VIII, far more beautiful, in my opinion, than Buckingham Palace. It takes place, this conference, in Hampton Court, where he brings together, if you like, the warring factions in the church to hear their grievances. And you can only imagine the expectancy as both groups go in there. Both have good reason to believe that this man's going to come out swinging on their side. In fact, he comes out more on the side of the Conformists. And knowing what we know about James, it's not a surprise. But he does concede one thing to the Puritans. They ask for a new Bible translation, and he concedes that. Is it a concession? That's a question to ask. And I think they certainly think it is at the time. But of course, what they're going to get is the King James Version of the Bible, which, both by process and in terms of its presentation, is really less useful to the Puritans than the Geneva translation was.
So who was favorable towards, other than James himself? Was this viewed as one of those things where it was simply a compromise and no party's going to be really ecstatic about it? Or do both sides, the Conformists and the Puritans, have high hopes that they might get something great out of this new translation?
I think both sides must have gone in with some hope that they would get something great out of it.
Yeah.
But of course, what James does is he sets up the committees are set up to do the translation.
Well, they thought they'd be working with their people, perhaps on portions of the Bible.
James is too clever for that. James was James should have been an academic dean somewhere. he's a great guy for getting people who don't get along to work together. What James does is he sets up these. Yeah, in some ways, it's a brilliant structure for Bible translation, and one that's been replicated down the years, in that it's not Luther in his study hammering away at the New Testament, turning it from Greek into German. It's a committee project, which is good because you're pooling skills and resources, and no single individual has all the skills necessary to do a great Bible translation. So it's a brilliant idea just in terms of how to go about translation. You have team, six teams of guys set up working on different books of the Bible. But the political brilliance, the strategic brilliance of it is you mix the teams up. So you've got Puritans working with conformists. So they're forced to work together. And of course, that's a basic basic part of leadership theory today. You look at your team and you pair up your weak guy and your strong guy in order to find people whose strengths and weaknesses
complement each other.
Mm-hmm. You match them up together. If there are two guys who don't get on, you put them on a committee and give them a joint project to do together. So James is a great management theorist before the term's coined. You know, he's a good to great guy before good to great was ever heard of.
Proto Jack Welch.
Yeah, but with a bigger tongue, according to Charles Dickens, of course.
So. Yeah, of course. Well, let's speak a little about the where were these committees held?
Oxford, Cambridge, and London.
And what was the task of the committees? They had to translate, but what kind of approach did they take? There are many different ways to translate it. Do you have any details you might be able to share with us?
That I don't know. I mean, if we're thinking about things like, are they dynamic equivalents or literal? I don't think those are concepts
that they would have been
wrestling with in the 17th century.
But they're all capable in the original languages.
Oh, yeah.
There are resources available for Bible scholars at the time.
And they're also, there are some great literary talents involved. In this group, Lawrence Chatterton, a Puritan, was nonetheless a great writer of English prose, and it's a significant period for English literature. So there's a literary aspect to all this as well. It's difficult to nail down, but if you read the King James Version of the Bible, the literary quality of the translation—that's
one of the interesting parts of the film that I enjoyed. When the word is read from the different pulpits and when you read it from one of the pulpits that existed at that time in that architecture, there's a certain ring to it you just can't put your finger on.
And you've got John Rhys Davies reading
well, you can't
booming Welsh voice. I say this in class, there are certain phrases that just sound grander with an English Welsh accent.
Sure.
The wrath of God as opposed to the wrath of Gad. I mean, it just has a kind of literary clout.
It does. So
I probably offended most of your listeners there.
Yeah, that's all right.
Just an aesthetic comment.
Well, that leads us to the point of, the issue of the role of the King James Bible today and its place today. Clearly, is an enormous historical role, and the Geneva Bible is still important too. I believe you mentioned you'd met somebody who.
Well, when I gave my lecture the other day, I said, I was asking somebody in the summer what Bible translation do you use, and they said the Geneva translation. Wow. The funny thing was, somebody came up to me after the lecture and handed me his Bible and said, look at the translation I use, and it's the Geneva 1599. So
they're out there.
It was reprinted a few years ago in a nice leather-bound edition with modern typeface and with the original marginalia as well. So it's fascinating to see that.
Yeah, I've seen it out before, but it's definitely a rare thing. The Geneva Bible, there you found two people. Clearly, the King James is being used by many, many more people than that, even today. And there is value in it, and there's a certain grandeur to the words. But what do you say is the role of the King James Bible today, particularly in what circumstances, in what church circumstances would you find it particularly well-suited, and in what circumstances might you find it not particularly appropriate?
It's a difficult question to answer simply. In my home village where my mum lives, there's a little Baptist chapel. It's just maybe two dozen people maybe there on a Sunday. Whenever they hear that I'm in town, they'll ask me, would you preach for us? I'm always happy to do that. And it's a King James only church. And they allow me to, I can preach from whatever translation I want, but I have to read from the King James Version. And it's always a great thrill to stand up there and read from the King James Version. It reads very well. It's like reading Shakespeare or like reading Milton out loud. There is a rhetorical flavor to it that's missing from any modern Bible translation. So this might sound a really soft way of putting it, but I would say special occasions in church, weddings, baptisms maybe, where you want to bring a certain aesthetic grandeur to the occasion, King James Version might be a very suitable thing to read then. I'm a big believer in the importance of pulpit prayer. I don't think pulpit prayer is something we do very well these days. The difference between private prayer and public prayer has become blurred to the point where people stand up in the pulpit and just pray their private prayers. I do believe that prayer, public prayer, is a kind of means of grace, and it's a way of leading the congregation in prayer. And that requires a certain beauty and eloquence to the language. You can have a bumper sticker that says, life is meaningless, and then you die. Or you could say, tomorrow and tomorrow. You could have that soliloquy from Macbeth. And you're saying the same thing, but the one grips your mind and your heart in a way that the other just goes in one ear out the other.
Mm.
And I think pulpit prayer should grip the heart. It should grip people. And the best way of having good public prayers, and I'm not presenting myself, I don't do it well at all, but I think the way to move towards having that way of gripping people when you're in the pulpit is to read good religious prose. And it doesn't come any better than the King James Version of the Bible. So I would say it has that importance as well. And then it has a general literary importance. The 17th century is, well, 16th, 17th century, critical for the development of modern literary European languages. The Book of Common Prayer, the works of Shakespeare, Milton, the King James Version of the Bible, Ben Jonson. All of these people, all of these artifacts are important in developing the language as we know and speak it today. And I think there's a beauty there that we don't want to lose. Mm. What's interested me about the 1611 anniversary is, you know, the Bible's chock full of stuff that doesn't go down very well in the secular world today. But the number of people who've come out, even in the secular world, and said, you know, the King James Version is a very, very important literary document.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting in that documentary is John Rhys-Davies is moved by what he reads. And then, you know, when he's asked, I think it's on the DVD with the extras, where I feature a little bit more, actually, quick plug for myself. But, you know, he's sort of asked, we were all asked when we were interviewed, do you believe it? Do you think it's the Word of God? And I think there's a moment there where you can see him inner conflicted. And the power of what he's read has clearly struck a deep chord within him. And that power doesn't just come from the content, but also comes from the form.
Mm.
And I think the form of the Bible is important as well.
You know, the Westminster Standards speak about God's Word, and of course, I believe chapter 1, I think it's section 5, is referring to the original languages.
Yeah.
But there is a certain way of phrasing that, and a certain way that they speak about the beauty of its parts and its grandeur and all, that you can't help but think there might also be something in the back of their minds about how it was read and how it was delivered in their day and age.
Well, and again, the reading of the Bible, I think, is something we neglect today in church. I love to hear a quick, shameless plug for my friend Derek Thomas. Much as I don't like Welsh accents, prod to Derek there. I grew up on the border, you know, where the Welsh were our big rivals in rugby and everything. So, but I love to hear Derek. And it's a treat when Derek preaches, when he reads the Bible. He takes so long.
Mm.
And I asked him once, you know, why do you take so long to read the Bible? And he said, because this is God's word. And I want my delivery to reflect the seriousness of what I think this is.
Mm.
I think that should be reflected in the language of our translations as well. Yeah, the translation should be accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And you asked, you know, where would it not be so appropriate, the King James? You know, if I'm talking to a friend or somebody who's never been to church, I'm probably not going to give them the King James. They're going to need to read a Bible that is more transparent to them. But that's not to say that the language and the painstaking way we approach putting the Bible into modern language shouldn't reflect the seriousness and the magnificence of its content.
Mm-hmm.
The King James Version of the Bible is still with us after 500, I'm just going to do my maths, 400 years.
Yeah.
Math is not my strong point. It's with us after, I do so much work in those two centuries, I'm always getting 400 and 500 confused. It's still with us after 400 years. Bible translations that were around when I was converted 25 years ago or so have all come and gone and been forgotten about and contributed nothing to the literary culture of the church.
Yeah. That's a great point. Of course, this documentary we've been speaking about, KJB, the book that changed the world, is available all over the place. I'll put a link to it in the show notes where you can pick this up and see Dr. Truman for all 30 to 45 seconds. However, it's not simply, I should say, not just a documentary of just scholars speaking or Ken Burns style zooming in on images, but rather it's probably half action. It's half of a movie,
at least historical half action, fiction, I would say.
Historical nonfiction, yeah. and then the scholars interspersed. It's fascinating.
The portrayal of the gunpowder plot as well. I mean, it's an action movie as well at one point, in that you have the gunpowder plot. I'm not entirely convinced the gunpowder plot is entirely germane to the narrative of the King James Bible, but it makes a great spot in the movie.
Yeah, it does, certainly.
I grew up, every November the 5th, we still burn Guy Fawkes in effigy. And there's one village in East Anglia where every November 5th, they burn the Pope in effigy because of the gunpowder plot.
Well, it's a fascinating documentary, and Dr. Truman's lecture is, of course, available through Westminster Theological Seminary, the full lecture as well. And, of course, you can visit them online at wts.edu. You can visit Reformed Forum online at reformedforum.org. And there you will find information about all of our programs, how to download them for free, and also a place where you can support us at reformedforum.org/donate. I want to thank everybody for listening, and hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.